Hi, it's Kai Rizdal, and yes, this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for Friday, the 28th of September, but with a twist. With the help of the BBC World Service, we've put together a special broadcast on the financial crisis. The BBC's Justin Rowlett joined me in New York for a live audience show from the Green Space at WNYC, looking at who's to blame for the crisis and whether we, the people, get the banks we deserve. So that's on this podcast. Tess is back next week with a special episode of Marketplace Money. It's called Tough Choices. It's the hard decisions that people with very little money have to make every day, not to thrive, but simply to survive.
How am I going to get six people fed off of $20? Got some chicken and a head of lettuce and some tortillas, and we make it work.
So please, tune in for that next week. Welcome to a special broadcast tackling one of the biggest stories on the planet. In the next hour, we'll be discussing the ongoing global financial crisis.
Well, folks, the angry mob has finally caught up to the greedy bankers.
People, banks, the question is, has anyone learned a lesson from all of this? Because one thing is for sure, this crisis is far from over.
The markets are fragile. We have a serious situation.
Those Wall Street bonuses are back, and they are big.
Big enough to rival those before the bailout.
This legislation will not stop the next crisis from coming.
They benefited themselves all the while wrapping themselves in the American flag and saying that they were really benefiting borrowers.
Let me tell you who to blame.
Who is to blame, and do we get the banks we deserve? I'm Kai Rizdal.
And I'm Justin Rowlett, and this is a special co-production from Marketplace and the BBC in front of a live audience in New York.
It's 4 years on since the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
Yet the world is still mired in financial crisis.
So who is to blame?
Welcome to a joint BBC Marketplace production. I'm Justin Rowlett.
And I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, it's become routine to blame the banks, but for every dollar banks lend, there has to be somebody out there wanting to borrow.
So surely we, the customers, we, the people, are also to blame. Is the truth that we have got the banks that we deserve?
We are here in the green space at WNYC New York Public Radio in front of a live audience, I should say.
Thank you. And joining us for the next hour are Eliot Spitzer, former governor and state attorney general of New York, where he styled himself as the scourge of shady dealing on Wall Street.
Bethany McLean is an award-winning journalist. She's written the definitive history of the Enron scandal. It's called The Smartest Guys in the Room. She's also the co-author with Joe Nocera from the New York Times of a book called All the Devils Are Here about the history of the financial crisis.
John Taft is a lifelong industry insider. He was CEO of Royal Bank of Canada's Wealth Management Division and has chaired the American Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association.
Ed Conard was a partner in Bain Capital with Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential candidate. His book on the financial crisis and the markets in this country in particular is called The Unintended Consequences. Thank you all for being with us.
But let's start with a couple of voices from elsewhere in the world. First from London and then from Spain.
I think banks were lending money to people who had no chance of paying it back. So then when they relied and they paid on that debt to other banks, it was like a domino effect that affected worldwide banks.
We have lived over our possibilities. We have beautiful cars, beautiful house, when we don't have the money enough to pay it.
So that sort of sets it up right there, right? Banks eager to lend, people eager to borrow. Here is the central question of this hour. Do we get the banks that we deserve by our behavior? We will do, let's call it a lightning round, and ask each of the guests to stake out their positions.
Okay, Ed Conard, let's start with you. Now, banking is a service industry, is it not? Banks create products to serve their customers. So in that sense, it's the customers who created the problem, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't blame it on the banks or the customers. It's really an inherently unstable issue inside of all banking systems of how you recirculate short-term money into long-term investments. And if you don't do that, you will get slow growth, high unemployment, and a smaller economy, exactly like the economy we have now, as a lot of money, trillions of dollars in our banking system, in our corporate system, and in our households, sits idle unused.
Which is amazingly unreassuring, I have to tell you. Eliot Spitzer, to the question of do we get the banks that we deserve? Are the people to blame? I mean, you know.
Well, look, this is one of those answers. Of course, everybody's to blame, but primarily a banking system, a regulatory system that was captured by a dedication to short-term profits, leverage, securitization. Risk was pushed to people who were not knowing that they were not put in a position to assess the risk. Bankers made huge profits on short-term loans and then had other people hold the bag and the downside risk. That lack of equilibrium between risk and reward is what drove us over the edge. Leverage is the word that always gets us into trouble. Read Galbraith's book, A Short History of Financial Euphoria. It gives you the blueprint of what has happened time and time again through history. Leverage baked into a system where people didn't have to bear the risk of what they were doing.
John Taft, it sounds very much like he's blaming the bankers there. And you represent the bankers, don't you? I mean, you guys, you know, Elliot's right, aren't you? You guys are the experts. You lent the money. You're responsible for turning a blind eye to the real risks, aren't you?
One of the things people overlook is that the financial services industry and system, not just in the United States and globally, is made up of literally hundreds of thousands of institutions, not just the 15 that get referenced every day in the media. And they were every much as outraged and disadvantaged by the financial crisis as were Main Street American investors and borrowers. I personally agree with what I think is the implicit point of the question, and that is that the financial crisis, the malfunctioning of the financial system we saw in 2008 and 2009 was not a problem that was solely caused by banks or financial institutions. Many parties were culpable, but clearly the financial institutions played a major role, and the problems that caused the crisis have yet to be fixed.
Bethany McLean, can we then say we'd be better off without the biggest of the big banks, and if we figured out a way to do without Wall Street, we'd be all right?
Well, I think one of the great myths about the crisis is that it was a myth of homeownership. This was never about homeownership. Most risky loans that were made were so-called cash-out refinancing so that people could withdraw equity from their homes in order to spend it. And that casts a more nuanced light on this question, right? It was consumer spending. But what do you do when you have a consumer spending-driven economy where most people are not making enough in salary to spend? And so the only way they were able to spend was by withdrawing equity from their homes. And that's why this is such a complicated question and one that still haunts us today, is because we have to figure out how to make our economy move forward. And to your question about the big banks, I have not seen a great solution for what is the banking system that we need to have today. There are a lot of people who say, let's take apart the big banks. What should we replace it with? In the wake of the financial crisis, we bailed out the big banks. Since then, there's been just a slew of questions and new regulations and new thoughts about this. And yet, we haven't ever paused, sat back, and said, what is the banking system we need to make our economy function effectively?
Okay, so we've got a range of opinions there. We've got a spread of responsibility between banks, the people, government there. But the truth is, as some of you pointed out, we were all involved in this. We all bear some responsibility. We were all involved in inflating that enormous credit bubble, weren't we? Living beyond our means, because that's what credit is. So that leads to a much bigger question, I think. What on earth made us think that we could get away with this over those two decades in which this credit bubble built up? Who wants to take that one? Elliot, go ahead.
Well, this is human nature. And if this were the first time this had happened in history, I think we might be trying to figure it out as a new issue. But that's why I referenced Galbraith's book. He does a brilliant job going back to the Dutch tulip bulbs and other instances in history where assets are deemed to have value that is simply not real because we enjoy it as long as it lasts. It's a narcotic. And that narcotic is very difficult to wean one from. It is leverage. It is the belief that this time with credit default swap securitization, we have somehow mastered the issue, spread the risk. Remember, The Greenspan mythology was that the market is so smart, it is properly accounted for the risk. These guys are brilliant risk managers was the greatest myth of all leading into this crisis. It's always the same. Too much leverage, too much debt.
John Taft, what was going on that let us have these low interest rates and low inflation and let us believe that all this was true, that home prices would keep going up and that you guys were the smartest guys in the room?
Well, I'd like to go in a completely different direction here.
Sounds ominous.
All right. Well, I'm going to get you back to it, though, but go ahead.
All right, that's fine. The reason we got ourselves into this leverage bubble is that we were trying to create artificial growth in some way. The financial system, and in fact, all of Western economic thinking and the way the system is constructed, is premised on the notion that you can grow forever. You can grow at 1%, 2%, 3%, 4% forever. That was the old world. The financial crisis was the end of the old world. My colleague from Bain is going to have a heart attack. But
we've got the paramedics outside. I can see him now.
But here's the thing. We are in a different world. We are in a world where sustainability needs to replace growth. And if you don't want to have another financial crisis like 2008 and 2009, you have to start thinking differently about the underlying premise of the financial system.
Elias Bittre, climb in here.
I want to make two real quick points. First, I'm not as negative as to believe that we can't have growth in the future. It does come back to technology. More people have moved out of poverty in the past 20 years than ever before in history because of technology and the spread of capitalism and market-based economics. All of that is wonderful stuff. I don't think that's why we had the crisis.
But didn't that low inflation mean that, you know, we had low interest rates, and it appeared that we'd broken, you know, there was a great phrase that was used in Britain, broken the cycle of boom and bust, and people began to believe that that was the case. And
the boom and bust, we still will have boom and busts, but I think the reason that we went over the cliff was just excess leverage, separate and apart from
too much borrowing.
Too much leverage. We couldn't afford it.
Bethany McLean.
You also can't look past the fact that as early as the mid-1990s, consumer activists were going to the government, to Congress, to the Federal Reserve, and saying, look, people are getting loans they can't afford to pay back. Now, whether you believe this was predatory lending or predatory borrowing, it almost doesn't matter. If you hear people are getting loans they can't afford to pay back, that should strike fear into the heart of anyone who cares about a sound banking system. And you could have seen even then that something was going off the rails.
The misnomer is that banks were making no money down loans.
Ed Connor.
Banks found outside investors to make the homeowner's down payment for them.
But the proof is surely that at the end of the day, people couldn't afford the loans they'd been given.
What matters, though, to a bank is how much collateral they have relative to the loan.
Yeah, well, let's turn it around. What matters to the people who borrowed that money was they couldn't pay it back.
Hey, folks, I'd like to...
Yeah, let's get the banker in here,
My company is owned by a Canadian bank. The Royal Bank of Canada, the largest bank in Canada, where Canada is all about too big to fail. There are only six banks. None of them failed. One of the major reasons is that there was a responsible mortgage financing system in Canada fueled by the innovative thought that banks, when they make a loan to an end client, ought to hold that loan to maturity. They ought to, therefore, know the client, and they ought to apply underwriting standards that make sense. Okay, that's the difference between the financial crisis not affecting Canadian banks and almost bringing us to our knees here.
This is knowing your banker, right? You can walk in and get a mortgage, and if you have trouble, you go see him and listen, can I wait for a month? And that doesn't happen
banking.
Anymore. Got it. Elliot Spitzer, quickly, go ahead.
That last point is exactly correct. The rules against bad lending here were not enforced, intentionally ignored.
An important distinction in Canada that has to be made, they hold the homeowner 100% responsible for the loan, okay? We allowed the homeowner to walk away from the loan and use the house as collateral. That's a big difference, okay? I don't think we want that as the solution.
All right, we're going to move off this topic in 1 second. John Tapp, go ahead.
Can't move off the topic. What is the home ownership rate in Canada, and how does that compare to the United States? What should be the point of mortgage lending to promote responsible home ownership? 62% home ownership rate in Canada, 62% home ownership rate in the U.S. What was it all about down here? It certainly wasn't about serving the end client.
Go on, Bethany.
It wasn't about home ownership. You look at these loans and you analyze them, and most risky loans were made to people for cash out refinancings, allowing people to withdraw home equity from their houses. If you had only allowed these risky loans to first time home buyers, we never would have had a financial crisis. This was not about home ownership.
And why were people withdrawing money from the equity value of their homes? It was to spend it. The growth of the economy in the years leading up to the financial crisis was artificially fueled by exactly the practice you're describing, which makes my point about growth having been one of the growth ethic being one of the causes of the financial crisis.
Back to the root of the presentation and the debate this morning, we're to blame, right? We wanted to have that money to spend it. Do we get the banks we deserve? Are we the people to blame? And do we all just need to change our expectations?
People talk about predatory lenders, and there certainly were. There also are predatory borrowers.
That's coming up on Are We the People to Blame from BBC and Marketplace from APN. So what we had in essence, was once we got all of this short-term capital and refis and re-regulations and all of this, we had this thing that went horribly, horribly wrong. Listen to this tape for just a sec.
After the bankruptcy, no, I don't have a thing put away.
Multi-billion dollar companies getting help, and there's people losing their houses, can't feed their families.
These tuition increases and budget cuts.
It's very disheartening to have worked so hard for 4 or 5 years, and you're ready for the world, and the world just kind of doesn't want you.
It's been very nerve-wracking.
Eliot Spitzer, have we at long last, to coin a phrase, learned our lesson?
No, we've learned it momentarily. Let me amend my answer a little bit. The question isn't whether you change your behavior. The question is for how long. The way I analogize this is it's like getting a speeding ticket. You go within the speed limit for about 10, 15 miles, and then suddenly you look down and you're going 75 again. It's a question of how long do we remember. And I think we only learned part of the lesson. I think all of the, you know, there's a kernel of truth in every one of the answers that's been given in terms of the foundation, but we haven't yet confronted the underlying structural problem in our banking system or our regulatory system.
Bethany McLean, you wrote a book on this whole thing. Why don't we learn these lessons? I mean, it's not like we've never had financial crises before.
Because the whole history of financial crises is the belief of too many people in something that after the fact is clearly going to be revealed as having been too good to be true. And that's the story of every financial crisis, from the tulip craze to Enron to the financial crisis. We all want to believe in something that, well, after the fact, we'll all throw our hands up in the air and say, why didn't we see it? That was clearly too good to be
true. But guys, isn't that incredibly pessimistic? You're saying, oh, we just got to sit back and let another one happen.
Well, I don't think we do. I think we can strengthen government guarantees, and we have to hold banks 100% responsible for loan losses, because if we don't, they'll make unproductive.
Does that mean let them fail?
We should not be – we have to differentiate between withdrawal risk and default risk. If they fail because of default risk, and they haven't even come close to failing because of default risk, we have to let them fail. One bank will fail in
isolation. You mean if they make bad loans?
If they make bad loans, one bank will fail in isolation. But when the issue is withdrawals, you have a
30%. So if people are coming to the banks and taking their money out, you're saying they should be protected from that. But if they make the bad loans,
banks go bankrupt when we have a panic and everybody runs to the banks to withdraw.
Protect that.
We know what the outcome will be, which is the money will sit on the sidelines available to fund withdrawals, which is why we have trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines. We learned our lesson, which is why the money is not circulating back through our economy, and we have slow growth and high unemployment. Until we unlearn that lesson or change the underlying structural problem, we will not get the kind of growth that we enjoyed prior to 2007 and the financial crisis.
John Taft, how do you get people trusting banks again and taking it out from under their mattresses?
Well, that is a hugely important question, because not just for the financial services industry, but here I would agree with Ed, for the economy and the country. Right now, investors are actually positioning themselves for more disappointment. They have over-allocated to assets, cash, and bonds that they perceive as safe, but which have embedded in them very significant risks. Cash, you lose purchasing power every year at the rate of inflation. Bonds, if interest rate goes up, you lose principal. You need people to invest in the markets, because that's the source of patient long-term capital that fuels economic growth. And that's not happening enough right now. How do you get people to trust again? There is no one simple answer. I personally believe that a lot has happened since the financial crisis to make the system safer, sounder, and more secure. To the former point, and then I'll wrap it up here on this answer, but there will always be crises. There will always be bubbles. The trick is to contain them so they don't end up bringing the system down. And since 2008 and 2009, we have done a lot in the U.S. and globally to put firewalls in that will help contain future bubbles. So I do think the system is safer. People just don't believe it yet.
Now, the Occupy movement has been very vocal in articulating this issue of trust and the failure of people, the fact that people have stopped trusting our banks. Now, we have somebody from the Occupy movement. I can't call you a spokesman, can I, Justin? Justin Wiedas is with Occupy. Do you think this issue of trust is anywhere near being resolved?
Absolutely not. No, the trust has been eroded completely among the 99%, the general public. I think until there's accountability for those who committed fraud on Wall Street, and the fraud was rampant, we know it. Whether the captured regulators or the government acknowledge it, there has been rampant fraud, and nobody has been held accountable for it years later. There will be no return of trust to the system until people are held accountable, and that means we're going to need to see some bankers behind bars.
Eliot Spitzer, you're a former prosecutor. What have you guys been doing?
Well, I've been stuffing cash into my mouth. Now, to answer to the last question, I think part of the reason money's coming out is interest rates are zero. I mean, that's another macro issue. But as long as interest rates are zero, people don't have a compelling reason to put their money into the bank. And that's mm-hmm.
No, but come on, you're not denying there's an issue. There is an issue of trust here.
Of course there is. No, there's an enormous issue of trust, and I have been very supportive of the Occupy movement. You know, at different points in time, I think the accountability issue is very real, both on the regulatory side and on the banking side. Not that every banker was bad. Let's not get carried away with gross generalizations. There was a gross incentive mismatch to do bad things based upon short-term returns. A lot of the debt that was issued was based upon misrepresentation and bad stuff happening. I think the Department of Justice has failed. I think that many of the offices that had jurisdiction over this issue have failed and not brought cases, civil or criminal, that they should have brought, not even significant civil cases.
But hold on a second. This isn't just before the financial crisis. We've got all sorts of scandals that have happened subsequently. LIBOR, we've got the rogue traders in London, we've got money laundering cases. You know, it's not as if the industry's cleaned itself up, is it?
No, I agree. Look, I've been rather vocal in saying the prosecutorial world has not been sufficiently aggressive in bringing the cases to say to the world there is accountability. And I think that there has not been, as John said, there's not been a cultural shift on the street that yet recognizes the underlying obligation to fiduciary duty.
We need to be clear, though, that it's not just perverse incentives in the system. Those exist, absolutely, but there was fraud committed.
Oh, yeah.
There were criminal acts
mm-hmm.
committed. There was lying to investors. There was rate fixing. All of these things that have happened in the last few years have not been brought to light. The lawyers in the Department of Justice, the entire government, has not taken on its responsibility to defend the interests of the people that have been so set back by this crisis, and until there's accountability for those people, there will not be a return of trust to this system.
Bethany McLean, do you think there has been a failure to hold the right people accountable?
I think it's more complicated than most of us would like to believe, because I think there's a big gap between criminal wrongdoing and ethical wrongdoing. You look at Enron, which most people believe was a fraud, and in common sense terms, it was a fraud. Very, very difficult to prosecute criminally. Only narrowly prosecutable, because most of what they did was actually technically legal, signed off on by accountants and lawyers. I think you face some of the same problems in prosecuting the financial crisis. To me, I guess, I don't think the call for prosecution is necessarily a solution. I think we should all have an explanation for why these things can't be prosecuted. But look at all the prosecutions: Enron, WorldCom, Quest. The whole idea was this is going to deter future wrongdoing. It didn't. We had the financial crisis a few short years later. To me, the only solution that's going to make a difference is compensation. When you look at the amount of money that financial services people made, and they were being paid because they were supposedly great risk managers, so competent, and it turned out they were totally incompetent. And that, to me, is the heist that took place. Hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation paid to people who couldn't do the jobs they were being paid to do. And until you fix that dynamic where failure is rewarded, not just in the financial system, but in corporate America, where people who run companies and are at high levels get paid a ton more than average workers for failure, I have nothing against people getting paid for success. But getting paid for failure, until we find a way to fix that, we've got a problem.
John Taft, it's time. Yeah. You can hear a lot of support in the audience for that. John Taft, it's time for the banking industry to make reparations, pay back some of the money that they made in the boom years.
You don't think that's happened?
Not to a huge extent, has it? Where has it happened?
Well, it has in many different ways. The idea that shareholders of and management teams in banking institutions didn't regurgitate vast sums of their net worths as the stock, a value of these stocks went to near zero in some cases. I mean, people were they were wiped out, and the banking industry, in spite of maybe they could have been more zealous, but there are billions of dollars in fines and reparations that the banking industry has paid for behavior that was adjudged to be criminal or in violation of regulatory behavior. I think, though, that the focus on, you know, sending people to jail and criminal convictions is beside.
That's not what Bethany's saying. She's saying.
No, but that's exactly right. I want to emphasize what she's saying. That's not the problem. There is a whole lot of behavior that has gone on in the financial services industry that shouldn't be going on, that is not consistent with a stewardship principle. And that's what we need to focus on, not sending people to jail.
Well, let's go to a guy in the audience who knows a little bit something about this. Wilbur Ross is a private equity investor. He's here with us this morning. He's a turnaround financier. He is also, according to some polls, one of the most respected people in American finance. And Mr. Ross, I want to ask you this, to Bethany's question and then to what John was talking about. Is our financial system broken? And if so, how do we fix it?
I think it's much more complicated than that, because I think a lot of the problem has started on the borrower side.
Borrowing far more than they make. Now, keeping up with the Joneses, right? They want what they want when they want it.
Yeah, and some of that was predatory borrowing. And people talk about predatory lenders, and there certainly were. There also are predatory borrowers. The guys who falsified their mortgage applications, I think, are every bit as much at fault as the bankers who didn't verify and process them. So I don't think that the guilt here is confined to the financial sector. It's a problem endemic to the population. And I think the real root of the borrowing problem is that median family income, inflation adjusted, has gone down almost repeatedly for more than 10 years. But everybody wants to live a bit better each year. And the way they accomplished that was by borrowing.
But on this question of the financial sector, I mean, you've invested. You're a big investor. You've known something.
Well, we're post-crash investors.
You're post-crash investors. That's what I want to come on to. But you're a big investor. You're known as the king of bankruptcy. You've invested in the past over decades in steel and other big industries. Now your big focus, correct me if I'm wrong, Wilbur, is the banking sector. Clearly, you think there's something, you know, that there's some potential in the sector still.
Right?
Well, the world can't function without banks, much as we might like it to. You need banks. You need somebody to take the excess savings and put them to where borrowings are needed. So anybody who thinks you can live without banks is silly.
What do you make of this, though, that maybe we'd be better off if banking was just boring again instead of, you know, subordinated tranches and all that?
Well, and we might be healthier if we went back to living in caves.
Can I respond to Wilbur for a second? I assume your data is absolutely correct. That doesn't explain the specific boom and bust we had in 2008. And I think your point about we need banks. Intermediation is something without which a modern economy cannot survive. The question is, what is the appropriate return to that capital? And when you looked at the return to capital pre-boom years, you got the sense something was amiss. And that should have been one of the indicators that there was too much return right there that wasn't really reflected in what they were investing in. So, look, I'm not going to give you advice on your investment, but I don't think we're going to go back to that return to capital.
Yeah, I think what we need are banks being what they were when I was a little boy. You walked in, you knew the teller knew you, they lent to people they knew, and more or less performed
it. So back to a more traditional form of banking.
Yeah, I think old...
Justin Wiedes, Occupy. Do you agree with that? Is that what we need?
I think it's easy to blame working people for spending beyond their means, but you have to look at why people were spending and are spending in the way that they are. We have a system where inflation is pushing food costs higher and higher. We have an educational bubble happening right now where people are being pushed into more and more student loan debt. Healthcare costs are soaring. We all know this, right? It's very clear that Wall Street has done absolutely everything in its power to try to erode any opposition to these rising costs and privatization. And until those costs are brought down, students are going to continue to pay for their student loans on credit cards. And it's unsustainable growth, as many of you have mentioned. It's completely unsustainable. And we need to rein in those costs. And that is where it's on, I believe, Wall Street, and it's on our government to recognize the importance of giving some relief to people who are getting into more and more and more debt.
So here's a question, Bethany, just because. Can we regulate our way out of this?
I tend to be somewhat of a skeptic of regulation, I have to admit. In the wake of Enron, there was a huge hue and cry, and we passed this law called Sarbanes-Oxley, which became very controversial.
Wow, remember that?
Whether it was good or bad, it had absolutely nothing to do with the financial crisis that was coming down the pike. I think regulation is backwards looking. We tend to be looking in the rearview mirror saying, what went wrong? Let's fix yesterday's problem when today's problem is coming around the corner. And I think that regulation in the end relies on the regulators. And you look today at what happened at J.P. Morgan Chase this summer, where a trader in London lost what is amounting to almost $6 billion. The regulators were on the premises. They didn't see it. They didn't catch it. I think that looking to regulators to catch problems that are coming in a financial system as complex as we have is just an exercise in hopelessness.
Well, so But so what are we to do? Throw up our hands? I mean, come on. John Taft, the banker, go ahead.
Let me pick up on the J.P. Morgan thing, and I've been public on this. I'm somebody who thinks it's a good thing that the regulators didn't catch the J.P. Morgan problem. They shouldn't have. That's not their business. The J.P. Morgan trading loss didn't threaten J.P. Morgan. Because it didn't threaten J.P. Morgan, it didn't threaten the financial system. Regulators should focus on threats, systemic threats to the financial system.
But wait, isn't the J.P. Morgan thing emblematic of this entire mess? We have banks taking risks that are outsized and irresponsible when other people's money is on the line.
That's the narrative. I'll give you that. That's in the media, but it's inaccurate. Okay, so the thing about the J.P. Morgan situation, and I wasn't there. I'm not an insider, but from what I've read, you're looking at losses in a security portfolio that was originally set up to hedge exposures in a lending portfolio.
Right.
It was a hedge. Now the hedge apparently ran amok. And the losses, therefore, exceeded what the model was. That was a failure on the part of bank management. But the original construct, the biggest risk that J.P. Morgan takes and any bank takes is lending money.
Can I make a point about that?
Yeah, Bethany, go ahead. Bethany, yeah.
So I think that without personal responsibility, we're lost. And everybody is to blame for this. And there certainly is a component of this that was homeowners living beyond their means. But when you research the history of the financial crisis, the event that stood out to me the most was a Washington Mutual presentation in 2003 showing people how to sell people loans, riskier loans than the ones they wanted. So what to do when someone came in and said, I really want a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, how you convince them instead to take out a really risky loan because Washington Mutual could turn around and sell that loan for more money to Wall Street, and how you dissuaded the person from taking out the safe loan they could afford and push them into the risky loan instead. Responsibility is a two-way street. People have to be responsible for their financial decisions, yes, but the financial industry also has to have responsibility for the products it sells and markets.
But is ultimately that then about regulation? Is it about the government coming in and making sure that financial institutions behave responsibly?
No, I don't think you can get at this issue. You cannot get at this issue. Regulation is necessary. I am a pro-regulatory reform member of our industry, but it is not enough. You have to prevent what happened, get at the culture of Wall Street, which ought to be a stewardship culture. It ought to be, as Robert Shiller says in his book, Finance in the Good Society, about the financial system furthering social goals, our goals. It shouldn't be about the financial system jacking its own return on equity up through leverage and use of toxic products, as Elliot said earlier. So we need to get back to a stewardship culture where financial institutions wake up every morning and they think about what they're doing in terms of serving their clients and in terms of creating net benefits and adding value to society. We lost touch with that culture and we haven't yet found our way back.
Do we all need to change our expectations?
Politicians and many other leaders have seized on this, demagogued, blamed the bankers, made the bankers out to be a bunch of illegal guys, as opposed to thoughtful guys who are trying to get their money back. That's how you succeed in the banking business, by making loans and getting your money back.
That's coming up on this special broadcast from the BBC and Marketplace from APM. From the green space at WNYC, this is a special broadcast from the BBC and Marketplace from APM. Are we the people to blame? Do we get the banks we deserve? I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Justin Rowlatt.
Let me change gears here for a second and get to something. As we start to wrap it up, that John Taft said early in the program, the idea that we believe we consistently have to grow, right? Growing in this economy is what creates prosperity, and that lets us feel better about everything that happens. Are we all ready to change our behavior enough so that we're fine with 1% or 2% growth instead of 3 or 4?
There's no alternative. We are on a planet that is running out of resources, where the population is growing, where clean air and potable water are at risk. We have to change the way we're behaving. We have to live within our means. For 200 years, we have been living with an economic system, including a finance and credit system, that has permitted us to live as robustly as we possibly can. But as the borders narrow and the resources winnow, we have to change the way we think. So we do have to live within our means. And the financial system has to support that. And we have to find a way to grow. And we have to find a way to employ people in a smaller and resource-constrained world. That's the challenge before us.
Justin Wiedes, you're from Occupy. I'm sure you're going to agree with most of that. Do you see those changes actually happening?
I see changes on the individual level. I see people tightening their belts. I see people exercising thrift. I just don't see any of that happening on Wall Street. I see corporations holding more cash than ever in history. I see an immense amount of cronyism in which our government is putting municipalities across the country are putting people into debt relationships for things like public transit. And so we're paying $1 in $5 into our public transit system for debt service to JP Morgan. So I don't think that the people who really need to be thrifty are being asked to do so at this time. I think that normal, regular, working class people are being asked to tighten their belts. For what? For whose gain? It's time for everybody to start sharing in that responsibility if we're going to have, like John said, a sustainable future. Everybody needs to cut back in that way.
Elliot Spitzer, everybody needs to tighten their belts? I mean, you've already said that you believe that we can still have growth in our economies.
Well, these are not inconsistent perspectives. I think John's exactly right. We need a new model that is, and you know, folks who have followed either my political statements or the conversation about climate change and what the role technology can play, whether it's water or the air, every one of those points, John, is exactly right. That is not inconsistent with believing we can still grow at a rate that is at least as great as the population growth. I don't believe that we have to have declining standards of living. I think that the points that Occupy is making as well are correct in terms of the burden sharing and making sure that it is fair and making sure that government in particular acts in a way to make this one common purpose across all social boundaries.
Somebody once played a key role in regulating Wall Street said, Elliot Spitzer, who said, Wall Street titans utterly failed us and they still deserve our disdain and scorn. Do you stand by that statement?
Wow, that's tough language.
who said?
Well, let me amend it only because there's some of my colleagues up here. Some of them. You don't want to generalize it. It's impolite, perhaps. But it's, in another context, I would. I think the real point is that you can't regulate good judgment. You can't have a regulator overseeing every trade. A bank, the lesson I take away from the Morgan debacle this past summer is no good manager, and I give Jamie Dimon credit for being a superb manager, nobody is good enough to manage something that big without kerfuffles every now and again. So let's understand that. Regulators won't catch it. You have to hope owners will catch it. I wish shareholders were empowered. That's a whole separate conversation. Ownership is going to trump regulation someday in solving the problem. Putting that aside, you've got to put in that sort of preventive regulatory system that does, in fact, cabin risk. That's what we got to do prospectively.
Ed Conard. Ed,
I think we have to recognize that banks make profits for taking risks. And so the idea that we're not going to have banks only on the long side of the trade and we're not going to allow them to go short and long and make judgments about durations and convexity of the curves and all the things that go with managing credit default risk, I think is just – it's very superficial. It's extremely dangerous. It has extraordinary unintended consequences if we go down this path. And the problem, I would say again, is not loan losses. That investors didn't know they were buying no money down loans to subprime credits without documentation. Give me a break.
All right, Bethany McLean on that point.
Friends who are traders, hang on. It's preposterous.
Bethany McLean on that in 1 minute. I have to ask you, though, Ed, how much do you count on ordinary, regular people in this economy, based on almost every one of your answers today, not understanding what the heck you are talking about?
Honestly,
because when you bring out phrases like subordinated tranches and convexity curves, and I know that was tongue-in-cheek, give me a break.
I think that our leaders have a responsibility to not demagogue the issues and to explain to the American people how the financial system works and what the issues are. And instead of doing that, they have demagogued.
Okay,
demagogued
Ed, in a single sentence, explain it in a way that ordinary people would be able to understand.
That predatory lending and fraudulent securitization was the driving factor behind the financial crisis, and that we can, through regulation, eliminate that problem. But that is not the problem that drove the financial crisis. And so because it's hard to understand, politicians and many other leaders have seized on this, demagogued, blamed the bankers, made the bankers out to be a bunch of illegal guys, as opposed to thoughtful guys who are trying to get their money back. That's how you succeed in the banking business, by making loans and getting your money back.
Bethany
They're
McClain, go ahead.
A bunch of idiots who just go, I could get in and out of this thing and be gone before the problem comes, even though I'd like to have a banking career that extends to my retirement at 65.
Was that one sentence?
I think
it was. It was one long run.
One long one.
It's that whole one
He's
breath.
Good. He's good with his breath.
That's what he does. One breath.
There's a disconnect in what you're saying, though, because if risk underwriting were separate from funding, then we wouldn't have had a financial crisis.
Nonsense.
And in other words, biggest banks, Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Washington Mutual, Countrywide, let's keep Fannie and Freddie out of this discussion, and a whole host of others needed a government bailout because they couldn't fund themselves anymore. Despite the fact that losses on subprime mortgages did turn out to be much smaller than everybody expected, particularly on the safe tranches that these institutions were facing, they still had a funding crisis. The reason why, to me, I'd submit an answer, is complexity. When people started to realize that there were this mass volume of loans that had been made to people who couldn't pay them back, everybody freaked out. And so financial institutions that were holding slices like AIG that actually turned out to be perfectly safe ended up being unable to fund themselves anymore and to meet their collateral needs. And that ties together a bunch of things we've been talking about, which is the financial system too complex? Is the danger in complexity? I don't have a solution for it, but I worry that that's the problem.
I think that people, though, haven't seen a financial crisis since 1929, so they're shocked by it. But the history of the world is that we have had them repeatedly, and we understand them very well. And the problem, the reason why banks don't have funding in a crisis is that, think of a simple corn economy. You can eat the corn, plant the corn, or hoard the corn in a silo. Okay? When you take that corn and lend it out, and people run to the silo to get their corn, there's no corn in the silo to fund the withdrawals. So you have to sell IOUs, but there's no buyers in a crisis when real estate is dropping 30%. Assets fall to fire sale prices, and banks cannot sell enough assets to fund withdrawals. This is a problem that is well understood in academic circles and is not understood by the public.
Ed, I have to applaud a much more straightforward explanation of your case. There's a real danger here that this is becoming terribly self-referential. You know, are we here talking about what are essentially first world problems? You look across much of the rest of the world. You look at China, you look at India, Latin America, Asia. You know, many economies are only, if at all, feeling the financial crisis indirectly. You know, is this a first world problem?
Elliot, go ahead. That's a great face. What is that?
I don't know. I have to say, I've not really thought about that as much.
Well, the rest of the world, there are parts of the rest of the world that are growing that haven't had a crisis.
Well. China, 7.6%.
We would gladly take China's growth rate, even though everybody is now...
We take half of China's growth
rate.
Are you kidding me? Listen, in Britain, we take like 1% of it.
We're at $1 an hour.
That's right.
But it's a different context. Obviously, right. China is now what we were 100 years ago, perhaps, with huge supplies of labor that is reasonably inexpensive. New markets can be supplied with products. Yes, I think this has been contained to a certain extent, but...
It was a problem in the developed world's financial markets.
But it poses for me, and I think this comes back to a point that Ed made, one of the few, I should say, that is correct, which is that we were being supported primarily by the inflow of Chinese capital. And so if this is, to a certain extent, a first world problem, when China slows down, we are at great risk.
Let's go back to Wilbur Ross in the audience.
Yeah, but there's another big difference between the first world and the other worlds, and that's savings rate. We don't have a savings rate that's a third the savings rate of China. Unless you change the behavior of the whole population, you're not going to solve the problem. We are debt druggies as a nation. We really are. At the federal level, at the state level, and at the individual level. That's the root problem.
There's no regulation on the banks, so they were lending people money, and people couldn't pay the money back on these mortgages, subprimes, and everything, and it just everything collapsed.
Because the American people is so impatient sometimes, it's going to seem like there is no recovery at all.
I think in general it's not going to be as we remember it. I think we're going to have to all settle for a little less, but I have an optimistic attitude, and I think that America has to lead, and I think that's what we should be doing.
We've talked about responsibility. Clearly, responsibility is spread across lots of different actors in all of this, banks, customers, governments. But we all need to change, don't we? Attitudes, and crucially, surely, we all need to change our expectations. We need to begin to learn to live within our means. And an old-fashioned word, if I may use it, thrift.
Ed Conard, what do you think about that?
I think there are two kinds of savings. One is not really what drives assets in the United States. It's risk-taking that creates equity, that creates Google and Facebook.
But listen, as you said, if you've got nothing in the silo, what happens when the crisis comes?
They're very different kinds of capital with very different consequences for our economy.
John Taft, how do you feel about this question of changing expectations?
I agree with it completely. At the governmental level, the debt is fueled by entitlement promises that have been made to constituents who are electing politicians because they want to believe that those entitlements are possible to deliver with these level of revenues, and you have to borrow to make up the difference. But I wanted to pick up on your word thrift. A different word, I think a better word, is sustainability. And one of the most exciting things going on in the world right now is the amount of money flowing into what, you know, currently it's had lots of different names over the decades, environmental, social, and governance forms of investing. These are enormous pots of money, many of them coming from sovereign wealth funds, that are looking to invest in businesses where the underlying model is sustainable over time, rather than a model, as we've been talking today, driven by or based on borrowing money to generate growth that isn't sustainable. So sustainability for me and a financial system built on sustainability is where we need to go.
Elliot, go ahead.
I want to pick up on something Ed has been focusing on, which is the difference between long-term and short-term returns and risk aversion. I think the problem comes back to what Bethany talked about, which is the compensation structure. We have a financial system that became more and more geared to short-term returns because of the way bonuses and other compensation systems were determined. And that's why I think Wilbur actually stands in rather sharp contrast to that. His opportunities are created because he is patient. I don't know how patient, but he's patient. And that makes it possible for those who are willing to take a longer-term time horizon to invest in a different way. And that's why I think Bethany's right. Compensation has the banking system.
We'd all like to have more equity. You know, Wilbur's an equity investor. Equity investors are patient. More equity. I'm all for it. But that's not our problem.
But is it the patience? The equity is built up because of his patience. This is decades that you've been investing, isn't it?
In part.
You've built the money up over decades, Wilbur.
Well, when you get old, you think in decades.
He's a man of certain. That's the answer.
We all need to get old.
Bethany, go ahead.
I want to make a quick point about thrift here, because it comes to the title of this panel. Do we have the banking system we deserve? In really simple ways, one way to think about the explosion of financial industry profitability has been about the packaging of debt, governmental debt and personal debt. And if we stop creating debt, then the financial industry stops having something to package, and they make less money. So, yes, this does come back to a question of living within our means. It's a very powerful thing you can do, not just to take charge of your own life, but to control the banks instead of letting the banks can control us. But just a quick point on that, we have this dichotomy in our economy because you look and you see the headlines. Great news, consumer spending is rising again. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. We're supposed to be living within our means. Why are we celebrating the fact that consumer spending is rising again? And that's the central problem, which is that we're a consumer spending driven economy. And I'm not sure.
Ed Conard.
I think that both of you, Elliot and Bethany, talk only about the borrowing side of the equation. We say borrowing's bad, we shouldn't borrow. We can say let's not borrow it. That's fine. It's good. We'll end up with a lot of unemployment and slow growth because that output sits idle, unused. Now, it'd be great to say, wouldn't it be great if all that was equity like Wilbur and it's willing to take risk and fund businesses? It's not equity like Wilbur's. It wants to be withdrawn from our banking system and from our economy overnight. There's only one kind of loan we can make overnight, and that's the financial speculators, which is why there's so much financial speculation. It doesn't do anything for jobs and growth and building houses. Those are long-term investments. We have a problem in that we have a lot of short-term capital, and the solution up here is don't borrow it. Okay?
Hold on.
I'll borrow it.
Yeah, that's actually a mischaracterization of what's going on. Hang on one second. Let me change gears here for a second and get to something as we start to wrap it up. We started with a lightning round. Let's end with a variation of the same thing. Brief answers to the question of this panel. And Elliot Spitzer, we'll start with you. Do we get the banks we deserve?
No, we don't yet have the banks we deserve. I'd make Paul Volcker chairman of the Fed, secretary of the Treasury, and all of everything else fine, and let him craft some rules. I think he understands every side of the equation.
Bethany McLean?
I think we have more control in this than sometimes is publicly portrayed, and I do think that living within our means and creating less debt helps you take control both of your own financial system and by your own financial life and by extension of the financial system.
Ed Connor?
I think we get the banks we need. When we run up a large trade deficit, we get a lot of risk-averse capital. That capital's got to be recirculated back into our economy to get growth and employment up. The banks were doing that with subprime lending, which increased home consumption of homeowners. We don't have an alternative to that today, and we aren't going to find one as long as we sit and recognize that short-term capital carries enormous risks with it, which we didn't recognize prior to the financial crisis. And the problem is Keynes's paradox of thrift. It's not that people aren't saving. It's that in the short run, we're all saving way too much. Households aren't spending. Banks aren't lending. They're sitting with a lot of money. Corporations have a lot of money sitting on the sidelines.
John Taft, you're the banker.
Wow. I agree with Elliot. We deserve better. We all deserve a better banking system. But at the same time, we all have to behave more responsibly. And in my business, which is the investment business, there's a phrase which has always been true. If it's too good to be true, then it probably is. And we all have to keep that in mind as we go in and ask the banking system to help us.
And on that note, we have to draw this discussion to a close.
It is not a conversation that will end anytime soon. Christine Lagarde told me the other day during an interview, she said, you know, this is an unending process. So there's more discussion on this to come. That's it for us now from the Green Space at WNYC. Thanks today to our guests.
Elliot Spitzer, Bethany McLean, John Taft, and Ed Connard. And, of course, our audience here at WNYC's Green Space. And that's Are We the People to Blame, a special co-production from the BBC and Marketplace from APM.
Special thanks to WNYC and the Green Space for hosting us.
Marketplace's production team included Nancy Fargali, Sitara Nieves, and Bridget Bodner.
Kent DePinto and Philippa Goodrich produced the show for the BBC. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark, and for the BBC, John Zilker.
JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager at Marketplace. Tess and her team are back next week with a special episode of Marketplace Money. It's called Tough Choices, what people with little money have to do every day, not to thrive, but just to survive. Don't miss it. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Justin Rowlett, and thank you for listening.
This is APM.